Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's June the 6th, 2014, and this is The Last Word. My name is Michael Lawson, and I am broadcasting today from Raleigh, North Carolina, from the North Carolina Democratic Party headquarters. In fact, I'm sitting in the same chair where a lot of people have sat, who have sat in front of our new chair. Well, he's not that new. He's not that old either. But he's been here and has done a great job for the Democratic Party. But you will be hearing from him later, because today's a special day. Today is D-Day. Does everybody know what D-Day was? What D-Day is? Did you learn that in school? Because you should have. This is the day when we had over 160,000 troops run, push, and land on the beaches of Normandy. And what we are going to hear in the meantime is a promo that led into that great, great, General Eisenhower said, this is a great crusade. And you're going to hear a portion of those speeches from Chamberlain, who actually gave away half of Europe because he did not want to confront the Reich and Hitler. As a matter of fact, he sat down with Hitler and trying to make sure that they didn't get everything that they wanted. Hitler sort of laughed at it. Hitler did laugh at it. For the next 5 minutes, I want everyone to think about if they had relatives who served in World War II, where they were at if they were still alive during the June the 6th, 1944. Were you alive? Did your father go? Did your brother go? Did they go to the Pacific? Well, we were fighting two fronts, you remember, on two different oceans, the Atlantic and the Pacific. But here is what the beginning of our tribute to the D-Day invasion. The Normandy landings, codenamed Operation Neptune, were the landing operations on the 6th of June, 1944. It was the Allied invasion of Normandy, Operation Overlord, during World War II. It was the largest seaborne invasion in history and began the invasion of German-occupied Western Europe, which led to the restoration of the French Republic and contributed to an Allied victory in the war. Planning for the operation began in 1943. But in the months leading up to the invasions, the Allies conducted a substantial military deception, codenamed Operation Bodyguard, to mislead the Germans as to the date and the location of the main Allied landings. Using captured German codes and double agents, they sent messages to German intelligence indicating that the invasion army was much larger than it actually was, and that the main attack would come at Calais in northern France. They also played up the possibility of other attacks from Norway, Italy, the south of France, Greece, and the Balkans. Because the Germans were not sure where the invasion would come, they had to keep all their garrisons manned and could not concentrate their resources on any one spot. They guessed wrong. The Germans concentrated on Calais because of the great ports and landing areas. The ruse went far beyond simple misinformation, however. The Allies created a bogus army, the 1st United States Army Group, codenamed Operation Quicksilver, that went to enormous lengths to make the Germans believe that they were actually full of thousands of men. Indeed, their army was initially filled with men assigned to real armies preparing for Operation Overlord. Meanwhile, British intelligence created inflatable tanks and plywood battleships to accompany the tent city and base where the army was supposedly housed. Care was taken to move the vehicles at night and add tire tracks when possible to simulate activities. To make sure that the Germans were completely deceived, they placed a real general at the head of this fictitious army, the 1st United States Army Group. His name was General George S. Patton, a man renowned for his toughness. The Germans regarded Patton highly and were convinced that he would lead the assault on Europe. Since his forces appeared ready to attack Calais, the Germans dare not move or transfer any soldiers from Calais to Normandy, where the attack actually happened. Patton played his role well. D-Day, June the 6th, 1944, the amphibious landings were preceded by extensive aerial and naval bombardment, along with an airborne assault of 24,000 British, U.S., and Canadian airborne troops shortly after midnight. Allied infantry and armored divisions began landing on the coast of France starting at 06:30 hours. The target was a 50-mile stretch of Normandy coast, where they divided it into five sectors: Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword Beach. However, bad weather and strong winds played havoc with the landings, especially at Utah and Omaha Beach, blowing the landing craft east of their intended positions, which cost many Allied lives. The Normandy landings were the largest seaborne invasion in history, with nearly 5,000 landings, an assault craft, 289 escort vehicles, and 277 minesweepers participating. Nearly 160,000 troops crossed the English Channel on D-Day, with 875,000 men disembarking by the end of June. Some experts say that the death of soldiers and civilians from fighting, disease, and starvation in World War II could have reached as high as 100 million. Right now is our senior producer, Mr. Introduce Yourself, Thomas Fortenberry.
Hey, this is Thomas. Hi, guys.
Hi. I hear you clear. Was that clear? It's because we don't have a great signal here. I got two bars.
Did it go in and out? It was mostly clear. I think it only warbled a few times, but that's fine.
You were just right then. So we don't have such a good signal here, but anyway, we're going to, I thought I'd give a layout of what actually happened during D-Day. And right now we are going to play a compilation of Chamberlain, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Eisenhower, and closing with Roosevelt. These were speeches they made after Chamberlain found out, when he looked into his eyes and he didn't see anything looking back at him. It was almost the same thing. Didn't somebody else say, "I looked into their eyes and saw their soul"? Who's the one that said that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Chamberlain looked into Hitler's eyes and he told, Hitler asked him, "Did you ever serve in the army?" And he says, "No, I served the government." And Hitler says, "I served in the army. I saw what men had to go through, men dying because you government officials sent us into war when you didn't have to do that, when you could have prevented this whole thing." And he says, "What do you want?" He says, I don't want anything. As long as you keep polling, we'll be very glad. Well, that was the last time Hitler ever met with any allied person in charge of any. And Hitler, as soon as the man was out the door, he says, oh, yeah, invade.
Right.
And when we got back to the point where Churchill had been fired, and when they found out that Hitler just ignored what the old man said, they called back Churchill as head of the Admiralty again. And he said, I told you for 4 years this man was the devil and you didn't listen to me. And then before you knew it, Churchill had become prime minister and Chamberlain was going away. So this is how we're going to start this. You're going to hear from Chamberlain, Prime Minister of England.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we and France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
On Friday evening last, I received His Majesty's commission to form a new administration. It was the evident wish and will of Parliament and the nation that this should be conceived on the broadest possible basis, and that it should include all parties, both those who supported the late government and also the parties of the opposition. I have completed the most important part of this task. A war cabinet has been formed of 5 members, representing with the Liberal opposition the unity of the nation. The 3-party leaders have agreed to serve either in the War Cabinet or in High Executive Office. The 3 fighting services have been filled. It was necessary that this should be done in one single day on account of the extreme urgency and rigor of events. Sir, to form an administration of this scale and complexity is a serious undertaking in itself. But it must be remembered that we are in the preliminary stage of one of the greatest battles in history, that we are in action at many points in Norway and in Holland, that we have to be prepared in the Mediterranean, that the air battle is continuous, and that many preparations have to be made here at home. In this crisis, I hope I may be pardoned if I do not address the House at any length today. I hope that any of my friends and colleagues or former colleagues who are affected by the political reconstruction will make all allowances for any lack of ceremony with which it has been necessary to act. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival. Let that be realized. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time, I feel entitled to claim the aid of all. And I say, come then, let us go forward together with our united strength. What General Weygand has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour. When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British Expeditionary Force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, for years. If necessary, alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. Great air battle, which has been in progress over this island for the last few weeks, has recently attained a high intensity. It is too soon to attempt to assign limits either to its scale or to its duration. We must certainly expect that greater efforts will be made by the enemy than any he has put forth. Hostile airfields are still being developed in France and the Low Countries, and the movement of squadrons and material for attacking us is still proceeding. It is quite plain, sir, that Herr Hitler could not admit defeat in his air attack on Great Britain without sustaining most serious injury. If, after all his boastings and blood-curdling threats and lurid accounts trumpeted round the world of the damage he has inflicted, of the vast numbers of our air force he has shot down, so he says, with so little loss to himself, if after tales of the panic-stricken British crushed in their holes, cursing the plutocratic Parliament which has led them to such a plight, if after all this his whole air onslaught were forced after a while tamely to peter out, the Führer's reputation for veracity of statement might be seriously impugned. We may be sure, therefore, that he will continue as long as he has the strength to do so, and as long as any preoccupations he may have in respect of the Russian Air Force allow him to do so. On the other hand, the conditions and course of the fighting have so far been favorable to us. I told the House 2 months ago that whereas in France our fighter aircraft were wont to inflict a loss of 2 or 3 to 1 upon the Germans, and in the fighting at Dunkirk, which was a kind of no man's land, a loss of about 3 or 4 to 1, we expected that in an attack on this island we should achieve a larger ratio. This has certainly come true. It must also be remembered that all the enemy machines and pilots which are shot down over our island or over the seas which surround it are either destroyed or captured, whereas a considerable proportion of our machines and also of our pilots are saved and soon again, in many cases, come into action. The gratitude of every home in our island, in our empire, and indeed throughout the world, except in the abodes of the guilty, goes out to the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
Many American-owned ships have been sunk on the high seas. We have wished to avoid shooting. But the shooting has started. And history has recorded who fired the first shot. In the long run, however, all that will matter is who fired the last shot. Hitler has often protested that his plans for conquest do not extend across the Atlantic Ocean, but his submarines and radars prove otherwise. And so does the entire design of his new world order. For example, I have in my possession a secret map made in Germany by Hitler's government, by the planners of the new world order. It is a map of South America and a part of Central America as Hitler proposes to reorganize it. Today in this area, there are 14 separate countries. But the geographical experts in Berlin have ruthlessly obliterated all existing boundary lines. They have divided South America into five vassal states, bringing the whole continent under their domination. And they have also so arranged it that the territory of one of these new puppet states includes the Republic of Panama and our great lifeline, the Panama Canal. That map, my friends, makes clear the Nazi design not only against South America, but against the United States as well. Nobody who admires qualities of courage and endurance can fail to be stirred by the full-fledged resistance of the Russian people. Russia needs all kinds of help. The needs of her huge armies will continue, and our help and British help will also continue. That is his plan. It will never go into effect.
Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Cut off from the whole thing by a layer of clouds. All I can see are a few ships shooting like mad at something. But the mist is closing in again.
Above the English Channel, Bert Stiles strains to survey the scenes on the beaches below.
There's not a speck of flak. I guess all the flak guns are leveled, waiting for our guys on the ground.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these